Today we're going to talk about animals in the Bible. Over the years, when I've taught about various subjects, we looked at the way people in Bible times made a living, or we looked at ancient warfare, we looked at ancient trade, we've looked at a lot of artifacts of things they made, and kinds of things that we have in the museum now. But this year I decided, let's look at the animals in the zoo. So rather than call it a biblical zoo, call it a menagerie, the fancy word for a zoo. And don't just look at the animals, but look at how animals became symbolic. I like to emphasize, and the young folks don't understand this, but you all will understand it perfectly, how isolated, how separated we are now from nature. Think here we are in here, air conditioned, we do the lights like we want. You know, in the dead of winter we can be in here and be warm, or when it's raining. And we've separated ourselves from nature quite a bit. We can send people to the moon, we can send people deep in the ocean, because we can take our environment with us. And what's happened, of course, is that we've separated ourselves from the plants and animals to a large degree. Of course, that's good for some of us, because all the pollen have filters on your AC system at home. Some of the senior saints are more knowledgeable about the animal world. My mom and dad both deceased now, but they knew all about chickens and pigs and things like that growing up. Some of you maybe did also. To me, all those foods and food products come from Kroger. I'm strictly a suburban kind of guy. Dad and Mom moved out of the city of Louisville to out in suburbia, and I was raised in suburbia my whole life. So my thinking, all food is made in a big Kroger warehouse in Cincinnati somewhere, and it's distributed from there. I would starve if I had to raise my own food. But we're separated that way. Not the people in the Bible lands. So I want to emphasize just two things. Two things, mainly, and then we'll just run through some pictures. Two things. Number one is animals are extremely common in the Bible. Just start watching for them. If you know to look for them now, you'll be surprised at how many passages, how many biblical texts that you know well, how many of them refer to animals. And number two, not only are there a lot of animals, but they were so common, and the people had daily encounter with them, because most people in biblical times did not live in an industrial society. They lived strictly in an agricultural society. And most people in biblical times were in regular contact with animals. And so animals became so well known to them in their thinking that they became symbols, and that they could refer to them just without even thinking. We would say somebody's as dumb as a dodo bird, you know, something like that. Or you bury your head in the sand like an ostrich. I mean, we have, even in our language today, as separated as we are from nature, we have that language, a lot of remnants of those old sayings that are still around. But not so in the Bible. The Bible is just loaded with not just animals mentioned literally, but symbolism of animals, what they represent. Some animals represent power or might or magnificence, like the lion. Some animals represent danger, like snakes or scorpions. So different animals take on different symbolic meaning. So let's go through and see what we can find by way of the dozen animals I've chosen. Oh, first, I'm showing you a picture of our new grandson, who was that just happened to slip in here. I don't know how that got in here. This is right when he was born, 6 weeks ago tomorrow, but who's counting? So there he is. And he's just arrived last night at 1:30, his first trip out of Baltimore last night. And it took him 12 hours to get here. Yeah. So I think they're out showing him off today, is the term they use. So there he is. Welcome, Mr. Bean. The Near Middle East, that's the term we use to describe the biblical lands. Those are terms that come from colonialism, from British, French colonialism. You're sitting in your office in London, you're sitting in your office in Paris, and you look east. There's the Near East, then there's the Middle East, and then there's the Far East. You ever wonder why the Far East is west? It's because those terms are all British and French colonial terms. We didn't devise those terms. Those terms were used by the people that sat up in Europe and controlled the Middle East. These are the lands of the Bible. Now, the New Testament will expand that red area a little bit by Paul's travels up into Greece and to Italy, to Rome, maybe even to Spain. But that's the heart of the biblical land, those areas there, those countries that are so well known to us, like Israel, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Egypt. Right there, what we'll call the heartland of the biblical lands. And these are not huge countries as they stand as individuals. For example, Iraq is the size of California. Israel's the size of Connecticut. Lebanon's one-tenth the size of Kentucky. Syria is exactly the size of Indiana. So these are rather small countries, but you put them all together and you get a bigger area. And remember that we go from 10,000 feet elevation, the snow-capped mountains of Lebanon, down to the lowest place on the surface of the earth, minus 1,300 feet at the Dead Sea. In that difference of 11,000 feet, you have a lot of ecological zones, a lot of environmental zones, and meaning what? Different kinds of plants and animals. You have jungles in the Jordan Valley all the way to Arctic animals that would live up, you know, at the snow line in the Lebanese and Syrian mountains, and everything in between. I start out in Psalm 104. We just took our trip to Hawaii, and every morning you could look out the breakfast windows on the ship and see whales. Some of them breaching, sometimes just, you know, through the blowhole, blowing the spout up. Psalm 104, verse 24 through 26. O Lord, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom hast thou made them all. The earth is full of thy creatures. Yonder is the sea, great and wide, which teems, swarms with things innumerable, living things, both small and great. There go the ships and Leviathan, which thou didst form to sport in it. I chose deliberately the Revised Standard Version because it says God made the whale to sport in it. The term sport carries to us a clear indication of something just should be for fun. It's a big business today, I know. Other translations say God made the whale to frolic in the ocean. The whale is magnificent and as monstrous, as big a creature as it is. The whale, to God, is like a rubber ducky, in other words. The whale is just a creature, just like the plankton that the whale eats, you know, from the great beasts down to the lowest animals creatures that make this water teem with life. It's a magnificent passage. I always like to draw attention to the whole 104th Psalm is about God, the creator of nature. So it's just everything about nature. There's a cycle. There's a complexity built into it. There's an orderliness built into it. It's a remarkable, remarkable chapter of the Bible, Psalm 104. And this Leviathan reference is really sort of at the punchline toward the end of the chapter to make the point so clearly. Many different animals named in the Bible, as I said, from many different environmental zones. And think, even the land of the Bible is described as a land that flows with milk and honey. Now, what does that mean? Is there milk coming down the sides of the hills or honey dripping off of the mountains? What does that mean? A land that flows with milk and honey. Right. In other words, the animals that produce it. Now, in this case, not cows. The milk came from sheep and goats and camels. They didn't have many cows because cattle were not easily adaptable to this dry area. But to us it would be, sure, like a dairy farm and honeybees. I hear bees are disappearing quickly too. The numbers are really getting hit hard. But the Hebrews describe their land as flowing with milk and honey. In other words, it was good for the animals who lived there, who produced the food. Honey was the sweetest thing they had in biblical times. They had no sugar, so things were sweet only as honey. And milk was the mainstay of the diet, as we'll see. Genesis 1:26, on the sixth day of creation, when human beings are created, we also read, and this is really a handy way to divide the animal kingdom up. The Bible divides the animal kingdom up by saying human beings will have dominion over the animals in the sea, the animals in the air, birds, and the land creatures. So really there are three kinds of animals from the biblical point of view. Land, sea, and air. Now we know about these animals from three kinds of sources. We know about the flora and the fauna, the plants and animals of the Bible from three sources. We know them from texts, that is ancient literature, like the Bible, right? And there are about 120 animals mentioned in the Bible, 120 different kinds of animals. I say about because there are two or three of the Hebrew words we're not 100% sure what they mean because they're so rare. But we're probably looking at, in those instances, we're probably looking at different kinds of owls, different kinds of lizards, different kinds of birds, different kinds of fish, different kinds of gazelle-type animals. So that's how you get 120 different animals, because you have lots of different lizards, lots of different owls. And we know these from their texts they left behind. They left a lot of art, as we'll see, and, of course, through excavations, through archaeology. This field is called zooarchaeology, the study of animal bones. And we know, like on the site where we work in Jordan, I'll be there in less than 2 weeks again. This is our seventh summer to go to this site. We know exactly what our people who lived there in 700 B.C. ate, because we know the plants they ate, we know the animals that they had, and have left behind a good record. About 36 kinds of animals we found, and 50 different kinds of plants we found. 50 different kinds of plants they used. Even out on the edge of the desert. Our site's on the desert. No grass, no trees, not a tree in sight. I love it. Lawnmower business would not do well out there. We know about animals through texts, art, and archaeology. And we can divide them even in different ways, more than what the Bible does. The Bible says land, sea, and air. We can say some animals are domesticated or some are wild, you know, like a sheep versus a lion. Or we could say a goat, domesticated goat versus a wild goat, right? There are wild goats in the Bible. There are lots of wild goats, wild sheep. People still go sheep hunting. So some of these animals are domesticated, some of them are wild, and some of them, of course, have never been domesticated, like a cobra, you know, or a hyena, or a lion. And then we have animals that are dangerous and harmless. That's important to us. When we go to the Smoky Mountains and I see a turkey running across the field, or I see a deer, that's one thing. But the last time we were there, we were sitting out behind a tree and I saw something I'd never seen. Maybe 50 yards away, I turned, and a bear just stood up out of the tall grass. He was in grass this high. And he stood up, and there he was looking at me. And I thought, uh-oh. And then about a second later, another one stood up over there. I said, well, I think we better go to the car. And so we went over to the car. So you have animals that are dangerous, animals that are harmless. Bambi, you know, versus a grizzly bear. And the Middle East had brown bears, so they had pretty good-sized bears. There are animals that are clean and unclean. This all comes out of Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14. This would be the laws of diet that the Hebrews live by. We call these kosher, right? The Hebrew word is kosher. So we even say something's kosher. Yeah, that's kosher. This is not kosher. The word kosher, kosher, means fit or acceptable. So kosher food is food that is fit for consumption. So the Hebrews had, by the law, divided animals up into clean and unclean. There are animals that are extinct, used to be there, but no longer there, or they're still there. There are animals that are useful for food or useful for other purposes, as we'll see. For example, the pig, they had pigs in the Middle East, they had pigs even in Israel. The Hebrews did not eat them because they were unclean, but the other people did. That's why you have pigs in the New Testament, you know, like the swine herd, for example. Pigs were very common. The pig was an animal that they used only for food. They didn't use it to pull wagons, or they didn't ride on them, or anything else. They used it strictly for food. But most of the other animals were used for other things, and were more useful alive rather than dead. Let's take a look at some of these. I chose this Lord is my shepherd passage, you know, your 23rd Psalm, with sheep. Sheep were everywhere. We have nothing like this in our society. Sheep were more common, and they still are, when you get out of the big cities. We work out 50 miles from Amman out in the country, and we have Bedouin around us with shepherds, with sheep and goats, little girls, little boys, adults, Sheep are everywhere. We have nothing like this in our society. There are more sheep than there are dogs here. There are more sheep there than there are horses here. We don't have anything like this. And the point, again, I'm making is these animals were there every day in their everyday experience because, number one, it was an agricultural economy. They had to have them. I don't need animals. I get all my food from Kroger, you see, the difference. All my eggs come from the dairy case. I don't need chickens. Who needs chickens? I don't want to eat chicken eggs. I eat eggs from the Kroger dairy case. So this is the way we've separated ourselves. But in biblical times, these people lived right up next to nature. They didn't even have screens in their windows. And their doors would not seal out things very well. So for sheep and goats, these are the number one animal in the biblical world. The main animals in the biblical world would be sheep and goats. Sheep and goats. They were mixed, of course, in flocks. You could separate them because you would use them for different things. Many, many uses. And more useful alive than dead. Again, see, I have no use for a chicken alive. It doesn't pull a wagon or I don't ride it to work or something. Some animals for us are simply useful, killed and eaten. So the sheep and goats. Number one, fresh milk. This was the number one source of nutrients in their diet. Came from the milk and the milk products. So sheep and goats both give a lot of milk. Goats are better for milk than sheep. Then processed milk products, butters, yogurts, cheeses. We have cheese of different consistency, like cottage cheese or chunk of cheddar cheese. In the Middle East, they have consistencies in between those that we don't have. So you have liquid things all the way to brick hard. And again, lots of different kinds of consistency and hardness in between. They produce all kinds of milk products. This is the mainstay of their diet. Milk products plus wheat when they can get it, plus olives, figs and dates maybe. Meat is incidental. It's sort of an afterthought. They're mostly in there with bread, dairy products, some fruits and veggies. They can get them. Of course, sheep and goats are useful for wool and hair. Sheep give wool, the goats hair. The black Bedouin tents, goat hair. Still, to this day, they make their tents out of goat hair. Rugs, wall hangings, bags, camel covers, camel blankets, all this is made out of goat hair. Skins, when they're dead, of course, even the finest parchment on which the Bible was written, made out of animal hide, animal skin, very fine leather. Meat, of course, after they're dead. While they're still living, their dung, of course, fertilizes the field. And, of course, bones and horns. It's like the American Indian with the bison. They used everything. They didn't waste anything. You know, they used all the parts of the animal. And so, again, sheep and goats, very useful when they're alive. And still useful, of course, when they decide to cull the flock, you know, to get rid of the older animals. They also will reduce the number of males. And they'll have a high female-to-male ratio, and this is better for breeding. And so in a domesticated flock, you'll have way more females than males, and you'll have a lot of older animals that are still being productive because you didn't kill them and eat them. So they're well adapted to the environment. Sheep and goats, very well adapted to that environment. The kind of sheep and goats they have are the best for that environment. In fact, for the arid lands. This is a typical scene. This is down by the Dead Sea. You can see a big, big flock of goats with the shepherds in the back there on horses or donkeys. And again, a daily scene. Just every day when we go to the site and back, we probably see this 15 times, you know, in different places, different settings. The milking of the sheep. Again, the goats give a higher quality milk with more nutrients in it, more fat. The Bedouin tend to be on the lean side. They don't have a lot of fat in their diet, so the milk, again, is a good source of all kinds of nutrients. Without eating much meat, you get a lot out of this. And this girl on the left is spinning. In the museum, we have a lot of different things they use to make textiles, to make their clothing. When you shear the sheep, then you have a lump, and then you draw those individual threads or hairs out and then twist them to make yarn. And so she's spinning sheep wool into yarn. And this yarn then will be used to make all kinds of textiles. And again, a ram's horn, useful even in death. You know, this would be the horn. Remember in Israel, they would announce holidays with the ram's horn. So just about all of the animal is used. They eat most of the animal, none of it goes to waste. The fat tail on the kind of sheep they have has a fatty tail, and that's a delicacy, the tail. I've eaten one sheep eyeball. That's also considered a delicacy.
Did you think so?
I ate one. Here's another thing they use them for. What's this? This is a goat skin bag. And this is for churning. They've put milk in here, and then a girl or boy or the woman will sit there and just shake this back and forth. And they churn this to the consistency that they want. So it's fresh milk right out of the sheep or goat or camel. Camels give very good milk too. They'll shake it and get the consistency they want. And then it can be dried, it can be salted, whatever. They also use goat skins to make water bags. And you'll see even today camels with goat skin bags hanging on them. And they'll carry a small one around just like a water bag or like a canteen. I had water one time out of a goat skin bag, and you could tell a goat used to live in it. It had a very distinctive taste, and so I've turned down since then. But I had one time a drink out of a goat skin bag. We don't typically drink the local water anyway, but that didn't produce any ill effects. We drink bottled water when we're there. Now, let's shift gears away from sheep and goats. Let's go to horses and donkeys and mules. Very important in the biblical world. Horses, donkeys, and mules. The donkey, the most important of all of them. The donkey was the number one beast of burden. These donkeys were a species that were like the donkeys in the Horn of Africa. They're like the donkeys of Somalia. The donkeys of Arabia. So these donkeys are, again, arid land donkeys. They're strong. They do well in dry weather, sure-footed. They have other qualities like stubbornness that we draw attention to. But the donkeys were very important. But horses were very important. You know King Tut, Pharaoh Tutankhamun. There he is, the last part of the 14th century B.C. This is a chest that's about this big, small chest, made out of wood with inlay and then paint. And let me show you this central scene right here. Here he is, King Tut, riding on his chariot pulled by two horses. Notice they're decorated, spokes on the wheels. There's a quiver of arrows. Notice the two guys running behind him with fans. You see those with ostrich plume fans. They're not keeping him cool. They're keeping gnats and flies away. This is what they were worried about for kings, you know, to keep those pests away. You can see there are other chariots and horses coming behind, and he's just launching right into the enemy. If you're up close, you can see individual people here, and dogs are attacking the enemy. Dogs were used either for hunting or for guards or as weapons. They weaponized dogs even in antiquity, as we would say. So this is King Tut. So here's an example of how ancient art discovered through Howard Carter's discovery of King Tut's tomb. Here's how art lets us know about the Bible world. We not only have a picture of King Tut's chariot, we have his chariots. They were in the tomb with it. So we don't have to guess what a chariot looked like in the 1300s in biblical times. We have the chariots. We have silver trumpets out of his tomb. We don't have to guess what they sounded like. The Hebrews used silver trumpets at the tabernacle. We know exactly what they sounded like because they've been blown. King Tut's trumpets have been blown. So, again, this is how archaeology illustrates the biblical world for us. Donkeys everywhere, little boys typically with donkeys. This would be like a bicycle, used like a bicycle, but he's doing work. He's taking care of the flock of goats there. Some sheep mixed in. And again, a very typical scene. We would see this all the time on the side of the road. You have to be careful when they cross the road because once one starts, they all come. They're so, you know, follow each other like sheep, we say, you know. So we've adapted some of this, haven't we, into our own speech. Donkeys everywhere. We pass through villages like this in the morning, you know, abandoned villages, and often the donkey will be there, tied up sometimes, but usually they hobble them. They'll just tie their legs together. They tie the back two legs together, and they don't go very far. They just sort of hop around. It is a beast of burden. It is abused to some degree. It's kind of sad to see it sometimes this way, but this goes back into biblical times. Very common. Here's a great painting from Beni Hassan. This is a tomb painting from the 19th century BC in Egypt of a wealthy aristocrat. And all the walls were plastered and painted. And this shows a group of Bedouin, of Western Asians, Western Asiatic travelers, coming down into Egypt. We know what they looked like, how they dressed. We know their hairstyles, their weapons. Look, two donkeys, couple of kids, and these are bellows, you know, like you would use for working metal. So these people must have been smiths. And the donkeys is what I'm after, to see the different kinds of saddles. And notice also that they've captured two ibexes, like wild goats, and they have leashes around their necks. So they're taking them with them, either to eat them or to trade them or just as something to show that they've captured these ibexes. A lot of these kinds of animals would have been domesticated by catching babies and then you domesticate them. That would be how sheep and goats would have been originally domesticated. And this is a famous painting of Rembrandt from the 1600s of King Solomon, not a painting, a drawing in ink, of King Solomon in Jerusalem when he was crowned king, riding a mule. The Bible says he rode a mule. A mule is a cross between a horse and a donkey. And mules, to us, are sort of second-class citizens. But not really. In this part of the world, they, again, were highly respected because they were strong, they were sure-footed, they could, you know, pull heavy loads, they were good for riding, any size person could ride on them. And even some of them look very nice. Of course, they're a cross between either a male horse and a female donkey, or a male donkey and a female horse. So you end up with a mule if the father was a jackass, a male, or you end up with a henny if the father was a horse. So remember what it is. The mule then cannot reproduce, right? The mule is sterile. But it is the product of the breeding between a horse and a donkey. And they were pretty common in the biblical world. You can look up mule in your concordance, and they're all over there. People rode mules. But I chose these two pictures, great illustrations. You can't see them clearly where you are. These are just vintage World War I pictures. This one shows the British Army marching across southern Israel near Gaza, near the Gaza Strip. And this is the British Army moving a whole train of howitzers, artillery. And they're on... the loads are on mules. So this is a giant train. You remember the 20 mule team Borax? Wasn't that what it was? And, you know, the big heavy wagons carrying that the chemical, and they would have 20 mules, 20 mule team. And that's what you're looking at here. This is in World War I. They're still using mules because they're so strong, sure-footed. You want to move your artillery and ammunition carefully. And then this one, another picture, I was in the same area on Google, and this is Jerusalem when it was captured by the British, 1917, and this is the Australian Light Horse Cavalry coming into town. So those are not mules, those are horses. So a lot of Australians and New Zealanders came to fight in World War I. They called them Light Horse. Light Horse simply means it's infantry mounted on a horse. It's not heavy cavalry, it's just to get you there fast. So its infantry would ride in, jump off their horse, and then fight like infantry. So that's called light horse. So there are horses today being used, you know, modern times, mules being used in modern times as well. Let's shift gears to Deuteronomy 8:15. Deuteronomy 8:15, God says, I brought you out of bondage in Egypt, and I led you through the wilderness of Sinai, the terrible wilderness of Sinai. And Sinai is the habitation of fiery serpents and scorpions. That's what lives in the Sinai. It's a genuine desert. Rock and sand, some trees, some scrub brush. What are we looking at here? Can you all make out where you're sitting, what we're looking at? Good, that's a good way to look at it. Except it's not a trail. The snake is actually in under the ground. It stops and then it wiggles itself into the ground. That's the way it keeps cool and catches its prey. Here's a head sticking up right here out of the sand. Now see that head? This is a horned viper. This is very common in the Middle East. Our troops in Iraq, Afghanistan, they have this in Israel, they have this in Jordan. These are very common, very poisonous. Let me show you what you're looking at there, this horned viper. This is what's called a fiery serpent. Fiery means venomous, poisonous. There's what you're looking at. Is that mean enough looking? I mean, rattlesnake, eat your heart out. This is a horned viper, has the same triangular shaped head, those slit eyes, and there are the horns. Those are sensors. And that's the only part that it leaves out of the ground. It'll leave its nostrils and it'll leave those sensors up. And if you step on one, or if you're a mouse that happens to step on one, you know, you're going to be lunch. So desert animals, you know, have these kinds of ways. The desert is alive with animals, mostly at night. But even during the day, there are animals around if they have the qualities that make them makes it possible for them to live there. This is the kind of poisonous snake we have at our excavation site. We've killed many of these at our excavation site. It's a desert cobra, and they're black, but their underside is just a deep, deep, deep purple, indigo we call it, and they're usually only 3 or 4 feet long, but when they come in sight, we have to kill these because we can't. Sometimes we have 35, 40 people. We have 20 working there. In a couple of weeks, we'll be out there, and we can't have cobras within, you know, within our area of work. And our local workers say the only good snake is a dead snake. In Jordan, we don't really even know yet all the snakes. They haven't been scientifically studied to know which ones are poisonous and which aren't. So they just automatically kill any snake. And so we have an expression: shoot first and ask questions later. They'll chop first and ask questions later. But we have these, the Waltranesia aegyptia, the desert cobra. They have these in southern Israel and central and southern Jordan.
Does everyone carry
guns? No, we don't have guns. We don't have any guns. Some of the local people have guns, and they use, you know, when they go out, a lot of them carry a pistol or even a rifle. This cobra does not, it's not a hooded cobra, you know, like a cobra rears and it gets a flat area like a hood, like this. This is not a hooded cobra. And they tend to be more, they're on the docile side of cobras. They're not aggressive, and they'd rather escape than stand their ground. But once they make their presence known, we can't have them around. Here on King Tut's mask, again from the 14th century BC, solid gold, there's a cobra, there's a hooded cobra, and a vulture. These were sacred animals to the Egyptians. So very, very common. Snakes and birds like vultures and eagles. While I'm in the reptile department, and I actually was thinking snake food when I decided to put some lizards in. This is the number one food for snakes, of course. And raptors would eat these too. Eagles, osprey, falcons would eat these. So lizards are kind of, they're not the bottom of the food chain, but they're pretty low down there because there are lots of things that will eat a lizard, including a snake or a bigger lizard. And this lizard is a really nice one out near Azraq. This is out about 75 miles east of Amman. This is out on the edge of the desert. And look at the camouflage. Very nice camouflage there on this little fella. The Bible mentions many different kinds of lizards, especially in a list in Leviticus 11 where we read that they're unclean. Geckos are unclean, chameleons are unclean. They had a lot of different lizards mentioned that are unclean. There's the reference to chameleon in Leviticus 11:30. And did I mention camouflage there, right? Can you see the lizard? Look at that. Isn't that amazing? This is the thing about the chameleon. It changes its color to match its background. We use the expression, you know, oh, he's like a chameleon. You know, he changes, he changes direction depending on the situation. So chameleons are in the Bible. And this is the thing you really want to look out for, these scorpions. This is the really dangerous one. The rule in scorpions is the bigger they are, the less dangerous they are. The smaller ones and the yellow ones are more dangerous. There are 1,700 species of scorpions in the world. And in the Middle East, they have 25 different species, and all of them are venomous. This is the most venomous. We have these, and we kill them all the time. I've killed many. My wife's killed many. We give a prize on our excavation every year. We give a prize. In fact, it's one of these. We give a prize. We call it the Golden Scorpion Award. And it's who came the closest to being stung by a scorpion in that season. And sometimes it'll be, sometimes, he's safe in the lamination there. Sometimes we've had a guy with one on his shoulder. We had somebody had one in the shower with him. All the time you'll just pick up a rock or a sandbag or a piece of wood and there'll be one anywhere. They come out at night, and then we're discovering them all morning long where they haven't gone in from the nighttime yet. But they typically live in 6-8 inches in the ground. But what are we doing on an excavation? We're uncovering them, and so sometimes you'll put your trowel in, and they'll come out charging. They come out mad when you put your trowel right into their house. So you learn quickly how to fillet one, and because they're very aggressive. Once they're mad, then they can really move fast. We have these now in Tennessee. We have poisonous scorpions in Tennessee. They have them in the Smokies. They've been documented now. Of course, we have them all in the Southeast. They come up from Texas and Mexico. Very nasty. This is the thing that I cringe at more than anything else. But they're all over the place. Very camouflaged, of course. Some of them are different colors. You can see the scorpion there. They have a feature that's very interesting. Their skeletons have a protein in it that makes them glow under a black light. And they sort of are the color of your sweater, Mrs. R's sweater there. So if you take this scorpion and at nighttime shine a black light or UV light on him, he glows like this. And we take them with us. I have one. Our other team members have them. And at night you go in your room and you shine every corner. Or in the tents especially, you look around, you'll find them, and you hope that once you kill the ones that are there, no new ones are going to make it in. But they're around. They're like nasty spiders. They are arachnids with 8 legs, just like a really nasty spider. Their sting can be deadly for children, somebody that's sick. Some of them have stronger venom than others, of course. The 25 species I said we have in the Middle East, this is the most dangerous, the Death Stalker. With a name like Death Stalker, you know that you're not all that friendly. Did I mention animals that are harmless and animals that are dangerous? Animals that are domesticated and animals that are not domesticated? You could never domesticate a scorpion, right? Don't even think about it. Camels, though, are another matter. I love camels. We're not going to have time. We could talk about camels till the cows come home. We've got a few minutes yet. Look, we could talk about camels till the cows come home. We have animals. We've just kept them in our language, even though we don't have them. No kidding. We had students, you remember? We would have students come here from, I won't mention the states, Pennsylvania, Indiana, Ohio. They would get here years ago. They'd say, wow, this is the first time I've ever seen cows. You know, and sure enough, on the way down here, they saw cows for the first time, or they were, you know, they're over here in the pasture, and they'll go over and stand next to the fence, you know. You know, look at them like that. I say, you know, this is where hamburgers come from. No. I say, yeah, this is where beef comes from. No, I don't need beef. I get my beef at Kroger, you know. I mean, but they just don't know this. But camels, very, very important. You would not have had the Middle East trade, long-distance trade, and travel develop like it did. These are the ships of the desert. The one-hump variety we call Camelus dromedarius, the dromedary. This is the one you see in the Middle East most commonly. And this is in Wadi Rum. We're going to take our excavation team down here camping one night in about 3 weeks. We're going to stay in tents, and I'll take my scorpion light down there, too. And also, you try not to go out to use the little boys' room at night in the dark, because you don't want to be out there with all those nocturnal things, including snakes. But this is Wadi Rum down in the south. This is Lawrence of Arabia country. This is where he did most of his work, fought against the Turks down in this area. But the one-hump camel is the kind that you're normally on. But there is a two-hump variety called the Bactrian camel, the Camelus bactrianus. And this is on a great, famous monument. This is one of the most famous archaeological discoveries ever. It was discovered by a British scholar in Iraq back in the early 1800s. It's called the Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser III. This is from Assyria. And this obelisk stands about this high. And it has 20 pictures carved into it, five on each side. And what it is a record of his conquests, his victories in war. And on one of them, it shows Bactrian camels. So he shows a lot of the loot that he brought back from his military campaigns, including the two-hump camels. So they had two-hump camels as well in that part of the world. This could well be King Jehu. This is on another panel. This could be King Jehu of Israel bowing down before Shalmaneser. If this is King Jehu, and the text says this is a fellow named Yaw, we usually transliterate it Y-A-W, but that could be equivalent of Jehu. This is the only contemporary picture of anybody in the Old Testament that we have, these people right here. On these Assyrian monuments, we have lots of pictures. This could be the only biblical character that we know from a contemporary piece of art. Very interesting possibility, and most people believe that is Jehu, but there's still some room for doubt, so I put a question mark there just to be honest. Bactrian camels on a famous monument from Persia. This is from one of the great palaces of the Persians at Persepolis. Here's what we're talking about mostly, the one-hump variety. This is what you ride on all the time. I've done many, many trips on camels, hours and hours at a time, 10 in Sinai alone, plus lots of other ones in Syria and Israel and Jordan and Petra, for example. You ride on a camel on a saddle that rests here and up here, and then you don't actually sit on the hump. You sit on the saddle that's over the hump. And the hump is a big mass of fat. It's not a water storage. It's strictly fat. And the camel, again, beautiful design for the desert with snowshoe-like padded feet for walking in the sand. Really remarkable. They're nasty, mean. They put out a really high-quality milk. It's the preferred milk of desert people because it's so high in nutrients and the quantity. The camel is a great big thing compared to a little sheep or goat, right? This is on the Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser. Look, an elephant and baboons. You see these baboons? There's one even climbing on this guy at the end. They have leashes around their necks. I bet they do. Those things can be really nasty. They did not have elephants in the Bible. There are no elephants in the Bible mentioned. By the way, there are no cats in the Bible mentioned either. Big cats, leopards, cheetahs, and lions, yes, but no domesticated cats. That's my kind of book, no cats. And I knew I liked the Bible anyway. They had cats. The Egyptians certainly had them. They had cats, but they're just not mentioned for whatever reason. And elephants are not mentioned, but this is on a monument in Iraq, so at least they knew about them. But what do we know they did have? They had ivory. They had lots and lots of ivory. And ivories were used for decorating the walls or for decorating furniture or for jewelry. And, for example, we read in 1 Kings 10:22 that Solomon sent out a great expedition ever so often, I think every 3 years, and these ships would bring back all kinds of exotic products, including exotic animals and ivory. So they were sailing down into the coast of Arabia or even into the east coast of Africa to get elephant ivory that they would use to make all these decorated things. The camel of the bird family is the ostrich. Struthio camelus means a camel that's like a bird. It would be the Greek background. So Struthio camelus is the ostrich. Ostrich is just actually a corruption of the term struthio. It's a corruption of the Greek word that came into Latin. So, Job 39 is the famous passage in the Bible about ostriches. It's a magnificent passage. The book of Job knows Mother Nature very well. If I don't know Mother Nature, Job does. It's a remarkable passage in which he talks about He calls the ostrich a dumb bird. God didn't give the ostrich much wisdom, Job says. The book of Job says. But that's okay. We don't want to judge the ostrich by human standards, by the way it takes care of its children. You know the feeling of me looking at my daughter and my son-in-law being so careful and tender with this little baby. I mean, this son-in-law, he's really being attentive and helps. He changes more diapers than she does, I think. I mean, he's into it. But the ostrich is not like that. The ostrich lays its eggs on the ground. Here's an ostrich egg. My daughter works, she's a zookeeper, and so she got an ostrich egg for me. This typical ostrich egg, equivalent to 24 hen's eggs if you make an omelet out of it. So this is 2 dozen eggs. So if you don't go to Kroger and get your eggs out of the dairy case, you can just go to the zoo and get an ostrich egg. And it's pretty much like a regular egg. It's a little tougher, you know, when you cook it. But the mother will give the ostrich hen will give birth, in her clutch. She'll lay up to 20 or so eggs. She can lay as many as 2 dozen eggs. I'd like to lay 2 dozen of those. Of course, we're talking about an animal that weighs maximum about 230, 240 pounds. Big bird, 8 feet tall, the big ones, the big cock, you know, the big he-bird, can be 8 feet tall and weigh 250. They can run as fast as a thoroughbred, 43 miles an hour. That's as fast as anything will run in the Kentucky Derby or the Preakness. The difference is the ostrich can maintain this speed for half an hour, where a thoroughbred can only do it for a mile and 3/16. See the difference? So it's a remarkable animal. And they are funny looking, I'll have to admit. And I chose these two because they're so cute. There they are, full speed. The book of Job says, at the very end of that passage in Job 39, the book of Job says, the ostrich might be dumb, but he laughs at horse and rider as he passes them by. So in other words, the book of Job knows how fast the ostrich is. And sure enough, we know that it is as fast as the finest horse. Something like a cheetah can go faster in a spurt, but you know, just a short, you know, like an attack mode. But again, a cheetah or a leopard could not run that speed for half an hour, but the ostrich can. It's a remarkable animal. The ancients loved them for their feathers. They used them to make fans. They loved them for their eggs. They ate the meat. The meat tastes just like beef. It tastes just like beef. Yeah, everybody says chicken, but it's like beef. I'll end with this. This is amazing. This is a gold fan of King Tut. So we go back to the 1300s BC. This would be the handle. You know, the handle would come down here to the floor. Then here's the gold decorated piece. It's about this big. And coming out of it would be the ostrich feathers. You can actually see the ends of the ostrich feathers broken off now. In fact, here's a picture of somebody with exactly the same kind of fan. There's the ostrich feathers, see? And there's the decorated piece just like this is. There's the handle, just like there goes the handle, like right there. But what is King Tut doing in this case? What's he hunting? Ostriches. Here's one he shot, and there's one he's shooting at. And the ostrich is running, looking back, trying to escape. And again, you say, well, that, you know, that's not a very sporting thing to do. No, remember how fast the ostrich can go. The ostrich can certainly outrun a chariot and a man being pulled by a horse or two. So, you know, the ostrich has a sporting chance, we'll call it. Notice he has a hunting dog out there with him as well. So this is an amazing picture showing us the role of ostriches in biblical times. Let's skip that one. And I end with this one. These great passages to leopards and lions and bears. These animals are now extinct in Israel, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. They still have these in Arabia. There's still some Arabian cheetahs out in the desert. There are still some bears in the mountains of Iraq. These are brown bears, by the way. These are not little tiny black bears like we have here. And if you're out walking at night and you see something that looks like a big dog, you might want to give it some space because we have bears even around here occasionally. We had one at our yard not too long ago. Those are black bears. But this is a brown bear, you know, which is bigger. And they're now gone from the heartland of the Middle East. They were very dangerous in biblical times. The passage I put in there, Isaiah 11 refers to all these animals. This is like, you know, the leopard will lie down with the kid, a baby goat, and not eat it. That's the point. It's talking about the messianic age. But it's Jeremiah 13:23 we end with. It's a great passage. And you all know this passage. You didn't know you knew Jeremiah 13:23. God is talking to the Hebrews about how stubborn they are, how sinful they are. And he says, you people are so hard-headed, so stubborn. You know how stubborn you are? You're as stubborn as... And God says, well, let me ask you a question. Can an Ethiopian change his skin color? No. Can a black African change his skin color? No. Can a leopard change his spots? So there's where it comes from. That's, you've heard that expression. A leopard cannot change its spots. It comes from Jeremiah 13:23. An Ethiopian cannot change his skin color, and a leopard cannot change his spots. And somebody, oh, yeah, you can have tattoos removed, and you can have... No, we're not talking about that. We're talking about, you know, the way things are. You don't change skin color, and you don't change the spots. So I conclude by saying, when you read the Bible, watch for the animals. They're everywhere. They're everywhere. But only from Genesis to Revelation. You know, but they're everywhere through there. And the animals and the symbolism of the animals also, you know, in there. Some, as I said, dangerous. Some are their royalty, like a lion. The Lion of Judah. Who's that? That's the Messiah. You know, that's an animal symbol for sure.